folks, this is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history.
Tech.
And now, the news.
Tech.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video.
Where's the garage located where I can make my own Silicon Valley legend?
Over there, in the media corner.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts and disregard all safety rules. Here are your flight crew, Chuck and Craig.
Welcome to Technorama, the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. I am your host, Chuck Tomasi, and with me is Craig Stepp, bringing you another special. We're very excited to bring you another installment in our series from the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, California. If this is your first time listening to Technorama, thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoy this and listen again. If you're a returning listener, welcome back. We appreciate you giving us your time. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time in the introduction because we've got a lot of great stuff to cover in this audio tour and documentary. It's so big we had to deliver it to you in separate parts. If you haven't listened to the earlier parts of this special, you'll want to visit the website or download them to get the full experience. Without further delay, let's get back to Stan Seeler and the Computer History Museum.
Right.
So welcome to Visible Search.
First thing I spot.
Zork.
Now, to prove this is a museum, it's hard to describe exactly. We're standing in front of about 10-foot, 12-foot racks filled with several computers, all of which seem like old friends. I feel like I'm at some kind of family reunion. Mm-hmm. There's a Trash 80. There's an Altair 8000. There's an IBM PC with dual full-height 5 1/4-inch floppy drives. There's an Apple Lisa. There's an Apple IIc. There's an Apple G3 Cube. There's a Next workstation, a Commodore PET, which we have seen in the background of the IT crowd.
Have you watched that show?
No.
You should watch the show.
Down among the bottom are some of the larger ones. That must be an Apollo DN10000, of which I've never used, but I know of. I have done many Apollo works in my day. Larger Silicon graphics machines. Several Macintosh. I see an Apple II Plus over there. I know. I can see from this distance it's not even a 2E.
So it's Alto.
Oh, I love it. This is
that
a Toshiba laptop with the... I've worked with these things. A Tandy 102.
Now, a lot of people still use those.
Those are still in use by a lot of reporters.
Atari 800, Craig's love, the Commodore 64. And this is just the beginning of what appears to be a rather large room. And these are in great shape.
Somebody didn't take their Ritalin this morning.
Oh, it's a DN300. My mistake.
I'm sure we must have a DN300. It's just not on display. This is only about 15% of what we have.
But yours
is one Silicon Graphics there?
Yes.
It had to have at least one. This building is an artifact of the computer era.
It was
the Silicon Graphics International Sales Headquarters. So it's an artifact of computer history.
So let's start where we're supposed to start, at the beginning of this display.
At the beginning of time.
I'm going to let you record a little bit.
All right. And it is on this side. This is the hot side, right?
Yeah. So if you just kind of...
Okay.
Here. You don't mind using my earbuds?
Not at all. We've shared worse.
We start with abacuses. And mostly to show that mankind has been interested in speeding up calculations for hundreds or thousands of years. And you'll notice that there's at least four kinds of abacuses here, ranging from the Chinese with the two counters for fives, to the Japanese and Korean with one counter for five, to the Russian and the Afghanistan, which are just weird looking.
Yeah.
Plus the Western European, which doesn't have strings at all. It's just a board or a cloth with lines drawn on it.
Oh, that's interesting.
But it's an abacus.
I've never seen that before.
Well, you've certainly encountered the concept. Your kitchen counter at home, counter. That's where the counters were put out in early commercial use, hence the name counter. So those are counters.
I never made the connection.
In French, I think there's jeton, J-E-T-O-N. And apparently there's a town in Germany where every year they throw the old counters, which have accumulated negative psychic energy, I guess, and they throw them into the river and they use new counters for the next year. So it's a big ceremony in some German town.
Neat.
In fact, it even says jeton, Germany, 17th century. So possibly rescued from the river, I don't know. The next display is sectors, which are for the people who don't have video on their blogs, are kind of like two rulers joined in the at one end with a circular hinge, and they're inscribed with lines and numbers. They're in effect they're predecessors to slide rules. You would use a compass to measure two points, change the angle of the slide rule, and use a compass to measure two other points. They were interesting to be used. Galileo had a sideline. He manufactured sectors in his basement and sold them to, and taught Italian army officers how to use them. They used them for calculating cannonball trajectory. So between using abacuses for taxation in commerce and using sectors for warfare, we have two of the early uses of computers. And that's sort of almost anything we did use them for until you get to video games.
These are beautiful. They are brass, inscribed, I mean, dating back to 1687. It's one of those tools, much like a slide rule, where I wish I knew how to use it. I know I can multiply on a slide rule, and that's about it. Two times three, and I get six. But a sector looks much more elegant to me.
Well, both sectors and slide rules, when you multiply, what you actually are multiplying by is, this looks kind of like two, and this looks kind of like three, and this looks kind of like six. Right. It's very much an analog mechanism, whereas abacuses are completely digital. So it's an interesting contrast, and we had that contrast when we got into the computer era. We have digital computers and analog computers.
Now, down below, we've got, up on top, we've got the slide rules, and then we've got what look like stopwatches almost.
They're actually circular slide rules. It's the same concept, except being circular, you actually have more linear feet, if you want to think of it that
way. Okay.
So they tend to be more accurate because they tend to have more distance for the numbers to spread out on.
And then below that, we've got cylindrical.
Yes. And same thing. You've got much more surface area to wrap your scales around.
The Lord's Desk Calculator from England, circa 1900. This thing is huge. It's the size of a big wall clock.
There were serious instruments in those times. But for something invented around 1622, they had a pretty sharp falling off date, thanks to the HP 35 calculator.
Right, right. And these were used very recently, in the 60s. Yeah. The space program used slide rules.
Yeah. Yeah, I had one when I went to school. Never used it, but I had it. The next next thing on the wall is something that looks like a painting or maybe a print until you look very closely and you realize it's a weaving. It's made on a Jacquard loom. That weaving is done on a loom that's controlled by punch cards. This is a sample of the punch cards. They're a little bit bigger than your standard 80-column cards, but not much bigger.
Not much, yeah.
And you can see there's places for hundreds of holes on them. The program, if you want to think of this as a program, that wove the Jacquard print is about 20,000 cards long. Jacquard invented the concept of using these cards to control a loom. This is a salesman's model from the loom, the loom from 1805. So it was about like that, except a little bit bigger. And it was an amazing innovation. It sped up the making of silk by about a factor of five, which was a big industrial advantage for France. So other countries sent spies in to see how it worked. So very early industrial espionage.
That's funny.
He wasn't the first to think of controlling equipment mechanically. An earlier predecessor of him, of his Vokanson, controlled it with kind of like a music box drum. But the problem with the drum is it's limited in size. Whereas with cards, you can have an arbitrarily long linked list of cards. And in fact, they've had 20,000 card programs, which is what did that particular weaving. That weaving's also famous. Charles Babbage had a copy of it in his rooms in London. We've seen the receipt where he paid for it.
Oh, no kidding.
Well, he was very impressed with the concept of the cards, and his analytical engine, which was never built, was going to be run or controlled by Jacquard punched cards.
And speaking of Babbage, down here one shelf down, we have an actual gear from Babbage's difference engine.
Yes. Not only that, but in a few months... it's not exactly clear when, we'll have a reproduction of his difference engine sitting in the lobby, and we'll be demonstrating it. And right now there's only one other one in the world at the the London Museum of Science, and that's a photograph of that one.
Wow. So
he never made a complete one himself, but he made smaller partial parts of it to demonstrate to investors and to the government.
Now, prior to a lot of these rapid calculation machines, they used... Books. I'm familiar with looking up cosines and sines and things in tables before calculators could do that, but this is a book of products.
So you could quickly multiply, say, 707 times 72, follow it down, and you get 50,832. I'm sorry, that was 705.
Right, and that's the problem. Column. You have to make sure your finger doesn't slip from one column to the next.
And they've divided them up into, you know, fives and tens to make it easy to follow across, where we today use green bar paper. Well, or used to.
Right, and the problem with errors in these things is what led Babbage to say, it's too bad we can't do calculations with steam. Meaning with unerring mechanical accuracy.
Sure.
So, because he was involved with the production of a number of these books, and he wanted to figure out how to do it mechanically to avoid the problems. But it's funny you should speak of mechanical calculators. That's the next section. We have mechanical calculators ranging from a reproduction of the world's first mechanical calculator, the Chicard from roughly 1623. It could add and subtract. It can kind of multiply and divide, which is really difficult. Or ranging to one of the world's last mechanical calculators, the Curta from post-World War II. The inventor was in a concentration camp during World War II. He lived through it, and he moved to Liechtenstein and started his company. These are wonderful calculators. They can do all sorts of calculations, and they're hotly sought after. They were sold up until about 1970, so they're very recent. There's no electronics in them, and calculator collectors want them, computer collectors want them, a few sports car enthusiasts want them. There are certain road rallies that ban electronic navigation aids. These are not electronics, so you can use them. And they're the size of a pepper grinder, so
they're
some people call them pepper grinders. And they go for about $2,000 to $3,000 on eBay.
Oh.
And there's basically two models, that one and that one.
Amazing.
Model 1 and Model 2, or Type 1 and Type 2.
It's another one of those devices that would be just fun to learn how to use it, just to say you've learned how to use it.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. The simple things aren't too hard to do, but it does take some training. Speaking of learning how to use things, the millionaire here, which is a bit bigger than a bread box, is the first mechanical calculator that can multiply in one step. And it's pretty neat. You can select what you want, add, multiply, divide, subtract.
So AMDS. It's right there on a sliding knob.
Not bad for a machine made in Switzerland. There were some knobs here that we took off that let you set up one number. We've manually set it up to 225.
Okay.
And you can actually see that the wheels are slightly off-centered from where they were. Those are zeros, 2, 2, and then 5, those little gears.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to multiply 225 times 2, so we set the digit 2 there. Clear out the old number. And now one crank, and you can read 450. We should have a digit indicator here, but it's missing at the moment. If you want to multiply by 23, there's the 3. And now that's 5175, which is 225 times 23.
So there's an implied decimal point in here somewhere.
And there's also, you notice the little bell? It goes ding if you overflow.
Wow, we need web browsers with that today.
Yeah. Well, and I'm sure you've heard the phrase cranking out the numbers.
Yes.
Cranking out the numbers.
You bet.
This was made, I think it was 1899 or 1895. They sold about 5,000 of these things, which is amazing because when we were being trained on this, our curator said they cost a working man's salary for a year, but he didn't know how much that was. It was just sort of word of mouth history. I was looking in a 1906 magazine in the U.S., and I saw a competitor of this was advertising itself as $1,000. And in 1906, that's a heck of a lot of money.
No,
so these things were incredibly expensive. Oddly enough, they have not appreciated much. I saw one a couple years ago at an auction site for $3,000.
Oh, what a shame.
So compared to an Apple One, this has practically gone down. Well, it has gone down in value in terms of inflation. Which is
this has an elegance to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's in my house, there's a Victrola in much need of repair. It looks like a cabinet, but you can crank it up. Without any electricity, you can make music.
Right.
This has that same type of elegance. Without any electricity, it's all mechanical. There's brass gears. It's beautiful.
It's wonderful, yes. We'll talk about industrial design, too, in a minute. You notice that the instructions for addition, subtraction, multiplication are pretty easy. Division is all of this and using
tables.
This table. Even our head curator didn't know how to do division on this.
Prominently displayed in the museum's visible storage exhibit are the artifacts that played a vital role in both the U.S. space program and the Cold War obsession with national security. In the early 1960s, engineers from MIT's Instrumentation Laboratory built a compact guidance computer that fit the tight confines of the Apollo space capsule by basing it on the then-emerging integrated circuit technology. At the time, the price of integrated circuits was around $1,000 each. Today, of course, integrated circuits power such prosaic items as 99-cent calculators and cereal box wristwatches. Astronauts used a series of two-character input codes to enter commands into the computer. First used on the Apollo 7 mission, the guidance computer is on display in the visible storage exhibit. The museum recently acquired a computer used aboard Russia's Mir space station. He had to use the old Brown Victor up here.
Right. Well, you'll notice two different styles of calculators. We had one elderly gentleman come through on tour once. He said he was trained on the original kind of calculator, which had over 100 keys, yeah. 10 keys for each decimal digit that you could have. And he said he had to be retrained to use the kind of calculator that only has 10 keys, because in the old days, he said he would move his hand going up left to right and sort of hitting all the digits at the right time. Not entering the number left to right the way we do it, but sort of hitting all the fives and then all the ones and all the twos. It was a really strange way of entering things. But he said he had to be retrained to use the modern calculator.
I guess you would. That would be kind of tough to retrain your muscle memory.
But these are just calculators. The next display is the start of computers in a more fundamental way. In 1880, the census that we took in the United States, and we have to take one every 10 years, took 7 years to add up. And they were projecting that the 1890 census would take 12 years. It's kind of a problem.
When you do it every 10 years, yeah.
So they had a contest to speed it up, and there were various submissions. But the one that they chose as the winning one came from a Hermann Hollerith, born in the U.S. His parents had immigrated from Germany. And he was familiar with the Jacquard loom and using punch cards. We know that from his writings.
Okay.
We know he was familiar with how train conductors would positionally encode information when they punch your ticket as to whether you're a woman or
yes.
a man. So he took that information and he came up with these punch cards. They did the survey as normal. They came back to a data entry places where they took the survey, took a blank card, and they used this machine to punch your answers or transcribe them from the form onto a card. They then put the card in these Hollerith census machines, and you'll notice there's a little, almost like a hand iron press or a griddle press from...
It sort of resembles a file card from a loom when you're weaving.
Yeah.
It's got a series of pointing pins. And then what is on the bottom?
It's like one of those things like where you put your hand up against it and the pins stick out. Like,
yeah, that's true. Yeah. It's very true. It turns out that where the vertical pins are, if there's a hole in the card, the pin is able to go through and down in the bottom area, there's liquid mercury. So if the pin goes through, it closes, it connects, makes contact, closes the circuit, and the associated counter increments. You can see there's more pins and potential for more pins than there are counters. Plus, if they want to, they can wire it so that the first hole that is open triggers a corresponding flap in this little box over here, filing cabinet, if you want to think of it that way.
Oh, for crying out
loud. So they might set it up so that the country of origin controls which flap opens up. So the operator would put the card in, put the handle down, the various things would increment, open up, and one of the flaps would open. Operator would take the card and drop it in. Maybe it's a flap for born in Germany, or maybe it's a flap for born in Mexico. At the end of the day, they could write down the sums on the counters, clear it off, take the cards for born in Germany, and now run those through, and they have subtotals for German-born citizens, which is the kind of thing the government likes to know, average family size for native-born people versus immigrants. The end result was it took months to calculate instead of years. It was a big success. He'd leased the equipment to the government. He also leased it to the Austrian government. They did theirs in one day, smaller country. He leased it to shipping companies, insurance companies, anybody who had data, basically.
Right.
He eventually merged with a time clock company, a couple key punch companies, and renamed his company. He was out of it by that time. International Business Machines, or IBM.
You bet.
So the Hollerith
I don't think I've ever heard of them.
They used to make PCs, I think.
Car. Yeah.
They used to make laptops. They used to make disk drives too. We're in front of a little display case showing IBM memorabilia, including think signs in at least 5 languages, as well as a little booklet called Songs of the IBM.
What?
Yeah, they used to sing a song.
They used to sing a song.
Well,
do you remember seeing TV shows in the 90s talking about how Japanese companies did business, and you would occasionally see employees doing calisthenics or singing songs, and this is kind of weird. Mm-hmm. IBM was doing it in 1930s.
Yep.
So wow.
There's nothing new.
Men in suits, and they're sitting there singing a corporate song.
Oh, there's like 70 songs in this songbook. It's amazing.
I think as a manager, I'm going to bring that back to our IT team.
I'm sure your team would be happy with it.
We used to do that at Hewlett-Packard. I still have in my collection a 45 RPM record called Grab a Grizzly that one of the guys did to celebrate the introduction of a new computer codenamed Grizzly.
Could you sing it for us?
That one I don't know. But I do have a friend who sings Database. Never mind.
I can see where this is going.
So... let's move on a little bit. We've got some old punch card machines. In a normal tour, you can't possibly talk about everything. There's over 300 computers in here, so right. I will skip things. If I'm going to skip something you want to see, let me know.
Go right
then
ahead.
Then I'll ignore you. No.
But we've passed by a number of things behind us.
Four analog computers, mostly because analog isn't the main focus of the museum.
Goodness.
Digital computers work on zeros and ones. Analog works on amplitude and currents. So it's much like abacuses versus slide rules.
I recognize this box.
This is the start of computation during World War II. The box in the display case is an Enigma machine from Germany.
Right.
So it was used to encrypt messages generally from the high command to various people. The Germans used more than one encryption mechanism, so this is just one of the more important ones. It was actually invented before World War II, and some Hungarian and Polish mathematicians figured out how to crack messages very laboriously, but they figured it out. When they were being overrun, they sent the information to the British. The British then, during the war, built calculating devices called BOMBE, B-O-M-B-E, led by Alan Turing, of Turing machine fame, to crack the messages. Mm-hmm. And they had pretty good success until the Germans added a fourth encoding rotor to this, which basically increased the complexity by, I think, a factor of 26 squared. The British then sent the plans for the bombs over to the U.S., and we subcontracted out to National Cash Register. They built dozens of machines to crack the four-rotor enigmas, and we were successful at it. The British also eventually got one machine that could crack the four-rotor enigmas. So,
thank you, NCR.
Yeah, thank you, NCR. They were instrumental in helping us win the war, and there are a number of interesting books in that area. But in addition to the machines that cracked these were glorified calculators. They were not computers. They were not programmable yet. The British were also building another thing called the Colossus, which is a room-sized calculating device to crack Lorenz ciphers, which is you take a teletype and you generate random data and you XOR that over your message. And the recipient generates the same random data and XORs it again, and you have the clear text back. Neat concept.
Yeah.
So the Colossus was aimed at generating the same random sequences, trying to figure out what the sequences were. And once it got them, the message was cracked. After the war, Churchill ordered all the Colossuses destroyed. And this is one of the few remaining parts. Well, gentlemen don't spy on gentlemen. And he didn't want his allies to know that we were cracking their messages during the war. During, I think, the 90s, Tony Sale over in England said we should rebuild a Colossus because the 50th anniversary is coming up. And he couldn't get information on it from the British, so he came to the U.S. They had sent the information to us when it looked bad for them. And so he used the Freedom of Information Act to get the information from our archives. And he went back to England and he built a work-alike Colossus. So that was pretty cool.
That's funny.
So they
now, Stan, I got to take a pause here.
Sure.
I'm looking at not just the computers around here, but I'm noticing the furniture, this purple office cubicle style
That's
stuff.
That's strange, isn't it?
Do you know where that came from?
I don't know where for sure. I would have to guess Silicon Graphics because they did use purple.
Purple, of course. So,
because the building is from the Silicon Graphics International Sales Headquarters. So,
well, that does make a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's an interesting color. The thing that we're about to walk past is part of the ENIAC, the first... Well, everything in here is first if you use the right adjectives.
Sure.
And if you don't count Atanasoff's computer in Iowa before World War II, it's the first computer in the U.S. So maybe it's the first, maybe it's the second. It depends on how you count. during the war, we realized we needed new artillery tables because we didn't have very accurate ones. And if you're shooting cannons and trying to hit the other guy, you need to know how to aim the cannon.
Right,
and it depends on how far you're shooting, atmospheric conditions, all sorts of things. So the cannoneers looked it up in artillery tables. So the government came to the Pennsylvania, University of Pennsylvania, and said, help calculate new tables for us. And they tried having humans called computers calculate this. And it took forever because a lot of numbers. So Eckert and Mockley proposed building an electronic calculator for the government. They knew that there was one at Harvard called the Mark I that was more mechanical in nature, and they thought that if they could use vacuum tubes to build a faster one. Uh-huh. So they were going to pitch their project, which was called the ENIA, Electronic Numerical Integrator, and they were on the train. They added the word "and computer" because it sounded cool.
Yeah, of course.
So the ENIAC,
marketing.
they got the contract. They built the ENIAC, and like any good computer, it was late. It was finished about the time the war was over, but it spent a number of years calculating numbers, artillery tables, and doing calculations for the fusion bomb, the hydrogen fusion bomb project. But it was reprogrammable, but you had to rewire it to change the programming. And during the construction of this, that problem was talked about with Eckert and Mockley and other visitors. Somebody, and they don't know who, said, why don't we store the program in memory? Well, one of the visitors was John von Neumann from Princeton.
Yes.
He went back to Princeton and with some co-authors wrote a paper, which an early version got out without the co-authors' names on it, and it was sent to a wider list of people than perhaps it should have been. So he's now got the name of being the father of stored program computers, even though he admits it wasn't his idea. Still, the report came from Princeton with his name, and that report went to a lot of places, and a lot of the first generation of computers after the ENIAC were built using his report saying how a computer should be built.
Also during the 1960s, 54 AN/FSQ-7 semi-automatic ground environment, or SAGE machines, each powered by more than 50,000 vacuum tubes, coordinated U.S. missile defense systems throughout North America, effectively creating the first large-scale computer network. Ironically, many of the critical vacuum tubes were supplied by Soviet bloc manufacturers. Astonishingly, each of the 27 enormous SAGE computers housed two separate computers, the second serving as a hot standby in case the primary computer failed. MITRE, a public interest nonprofit organization that has become the backbone of U.S. government technical support services, was originally founded to maintain the extensive SAGE network.
What you're looking at here is part of one of the first computers built in the U.S. post-World War II, the Whirlwind at MIT. This is just a small fragment of it. It filled a small room. It's a vacuum tube-based computer. Most of the places you see circles here, there were vacuum tube sockets on the other side. This computer, however, is important to us for two reasons. We think it might be one of the first computers in the world collected to be in a museum. It was being tossed out at MIT, and some people from DEC saw it, and they said, this is wrong, we should save our history. And they grabbed it and they put it on display at DEC headquarters in Maynard, Massachusetts. And that was the start of the Computer History Museum in one respect. Because it went from there to the Boston Computer Museum, and then when they turned into more of an exploratorium, we inherited everything they had. The other reason it's important is it's the first computer in the world to use core memory. While it was being built, maybe a little bit before that, Dr. Anne Wang, later of Wang Labs,
yes,
had invented the serial core delay line. It wasn't random access. It was just a delay line. And Jay Forrester turned that into random access memory by basically having a matrix of rows and horizontal and vertical lines of cores. And this computer was the first one to use that. So this is the first computer in the world with core memory. Core changed everything. Before, core computers were toys, research vehicles at best, but they weren't usable in real-life calculations. But core made computers useful, much more important than transistors were in a lot of respects. Transistors made them more reliable and faster, but core made them useful. IBM was the contractor doing the hardware for MIT, so they bought the rights to core memory, and that made them a lot of money.
Uh-huh. Just looking at the difference between the ENIAC behind us and this one in front of us, this starts to resemble a modern computer. There are clearly circuit boards on this, whereas that looks like a wall of vacuum
tubes.
Well,
look at the back of it. You can see it's...
The back of the ENIAC is, it's hardwired pretty solid, as is this, but it looks more like a circuit board. There are places for resistors. There are reference designators. There are wire harnesses. It's starting to look like a primitive. You know what this trip reminds me of? In March, I was in the British History Museum, and I feel like this is my Rosetta Stone. This is the real Rosetta Stone. This is the real ENIAC.
It's interesting.
Pilgrimage.
It's sort of like a one-layer wire wrap board because there's no printed circuits or anything on it yet. I don't know when printed circuits came out. We'll have to find out.
I like the flip-flop storage output.
Yeah.
So and these are labeled. They are.
A flip-flop. Look at all that.
A flip-flop.
And it had, what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 vacuum tubes to implement a flip-flop.
And by the time I got to making flip-flops, it was a couple of chips. Well, actually, right. One chip, and you could make a flip-flop with a 7400 or 7404, yeah. Whatever it was.
I did the same thing in logic class.
Yeah, and there is a separate board, probably 20 inches by 24 inches, for a flip-flop circuit. And there's another one for a storage register, storage output, storage register, B register, program register. So this has all the makings of what would become a CPU. We're standing in front of a 6.5 foot high, 6 foot wide CPU.
Not only standing in front of the big computer we have here is a Sage. I talked to one visitor who said the Sage was actually two computers next to each other in a three-story building. Mm-hmm. He thinks he's the first person in the world to ever get lost inside a computer.
Yeah. I don't know. I think I've had that feeling a few times myself.
Well, now you can have the computer lost inside you.
Yes.
Now, he hasn't seen this yet. Should you ask him what he thinks this is?
Craig, what do you think this is? My first impression is it looks like a jet engine.
That's extremely common.
That's exactly what I was about to say. It looks like some kind of, I don't know, I've seen Doctor Who. It could be like a time machine or something.
It's good episodes this year.
It's an early.
It had. I'm glad we're among a Whovian. Yeah. It's a cylindrical object with radial arms and little circuits sticking out of these radial arms. There's some vacuum tubes, what appear to be large resistors or capacitors strapped to those little circuit boards, about 2 feet long and maybe about the same in radius if you take everything into account. Tell us, Dan, what is this, if not a Doctor Who jet engine?
This is early memory. It has 18 tubes of liquid mercury. If you've ever played telephone with two tin cans and a string between them, mm-hmm. You say hello into one end, and it vibrates a string, and it comes out at the other end, kind of weaker, hello.
Yes.
The same thing happens here. There's a speaker that goes on, off, and that sound goes through liquid mercury about 4 times faster than air, if I remember right. Hits a microphone at the other end, it picks it up, on, off, and then amplifies it and puts it back in again. So the sound goes around and around and around. And to find out what's in that tube, you simply listen at the right time. Pretty strange, isn't it?
That's
strange.
The speed of sound changes with temperature. So if the temperature varies by more than a few degrees, it stops working. This entire thing is about 2,000 bytes of memory, which is one screen of text, roughly.
Yeah.
A typical computer would have like 10 of these tanks. So that would be filling a small car, if you want to think of it in terms of volume.
Imagine how big it
What about heat?
It would probably put out a fair amount of heat. The mercury, of course, is not going to generate the heat.
Sure.
But the vacuum tubes.
What temperature did you say it has to stay
at? Whatever it's tuned at, and plus or minus 2 or 3 degrees, if I remember what one of the engineers told me.
And we all know that vacuum tubes fail.
Yes. That's one of the reasons that when we get to the Sage, we'll talk about reliability. But yes, the more vacuum tubes you have, the more likely it is to fail. So we start talking about mean time between failures.
This came from one of the UNIVAC ones, from Remington Rand.
Yep. One of the engineers who worked on this took the tour from me, and he said that this particular one was actually on an earlier computer called a BINAC, B-I-N-A-C, and that it was more commonly seen on the UNIVAC 1, and that's why it says that on the plaque. But from 1951, and as soon as core memory came out, these things were essentially thrown away. So it's a miracle this survived.
Okay, this is like a statue of Ramses II.
Yeah.
More like the artist's prototype of it.
Yeah.
Let me show you the two computers two of them that we've rebuilt.
Ooh, much quieter in here.
Yeah. Lots of those.
Wow.
The floor.
Oh, my. You have to use words because I can't.
This is a CRT, cathode ray tube, early kind of video display for computers. It's about a foot and a half in... maybe say 10 inches in radius, so 20 inches in diameter. Green, it's a, so we didn't have color back in those days.
Right.
Or we did, it's just one color, or green.
Like, or you green. Can have any color forward you want, as long as it's black, right?
And there's a light pen in front of it, so you could actually communicate with the computer by putting the light pen up against the display. So sort of an early form of user interface.
You know, when you look at those shows from the 1960s, and you think, boy, they really didn't have a clue what computers would be like in 30, 40 years. You now know why. This is what they were extrapolating on.
Right. Well, this is DEC PDP-1. It's the first computer from Digital Equipment Corporation.
Who was bought by?
Compaq, who then merged with Hewlett-Packard.
I just love this story.
Right. Yeah. DEC PDP-1 was a very, it was a relatively high-performing computer, but it was also inexpensive, and the story is that they called it PDP for programmed data processor instead of referring to it as a computer. Uh-huh. Because in the early 60s, if you were trying to sell to the government had these big tables of things. You look up in the table and a car has to be authorized by a certain level of management. A computer has to be authorized by a very high level of management. Typewriters, low level. Program data processors weren't on the list, so you go by the cost, and you don't have to authorize them as high a level. So it was a sneaky way of getting into certain armed services contracts with lower levels of authorization.
Now, I see something over here.
That doesn't look like it goes with it or originally designed for it, because it says right, left, thrust, fire, and hyperspace.
Yep. You can only guess what game that belongs to with a screen like that.
Yep.
Space War, the world's first computer video game, written by hackers back when that was a good term, at MIT, who are members of the Model Railroad Club. And the original motivation, I think, was to learn how to use the computer to control the model railroad layouts. But then they decided, let's write a game. And a number of the authors of Space War are volunteers here at the museum. And twice a month, some of them help out by turning on this PDP-1 and letting you play Space War against them. So Peter Sampson is one of the authors, for example, and he beats me every time I play him. And a real nice guy.
Now, there's other pieces to this besides the CRT. I'm trying to...
How about the amplifier and the speakers?
But there is tape.
There's a paper tape reader, paper tape bunch, and fanfold paper tape, which, by the way, is exceedingly difficult to find. If you know of any source for blank fanfold paper tape, we want it. Because we're trying to write new programs for the PDP-1 to use as demonstrations.
That's the storage. That's your external storage for these programs.
Yeah.
And one of my friends was telling me that the university he went to had a computer. I don't think it was a PDP-1, but it still used paper tape to boot. That was their boot ROM. And what they did is they taped the ends together so it was circular. So that you just gave it a yank and you booted the computer.
Well, that's clever.
And the printer. Explain this printer.
Oh, it looks like an old-style electric typewriter, a very early electric typewriter, but it has a little extra interface to let the computer type instead of you typing on the keyboard. So you can use it to type either direction. So, early console.
Which was still in use into the 80s. When people would buy typewriters, they would see if it had a Centronics interface, so they could hook it up to their printer, and that would be their letter-quality printer.
Yep, that's absolutely true. I'd forgotten about that. I remember buying a daisy wheel printer and making sure it had an interface on it so I could have letter quality. Wow. The PDP-1, transistorized computer, doesn't require raised flooring. That's basically the entire computer.
Nice.
Most other computers in the 60s used raised flooring so that
they could picture in the background.
Display. And that was on site as it was being built, the PDP-1. So.
And this still functions. That's incredible.
Yeah, it was about a two-year restoration project, again, by volunteers. That's the 1620 we rebuilt. 1620 is nicknamed CADET, C-A-D-E-T, and some people say that stands for can't add, doesn't even try, because it has no add circuitry. There's no add instruction in it. If you want to add something, you take X and Y, you do a table lookup, and you hope that the add table has the right numbers in it.
Lovely.
The reason for that is it's dirt cheap and very slow. When you're designing a computer, particularly in the 50s and 60s and 70s, you have a choice, fast and expensive or slow and cheap. and you can't do anything else. Those are your two choices. So this 1620 is slow and cheap, and that meant IBM could afford to lease them out to lots of people, so they're very common. The PDP-1 is a much more expensive machine, but it's also a lot faster. And it isn't until we get to supercomputers made with lots of microprocessors that people can break the rules and have relatively cheap and still be very fast.
I was noticing that you can actually use the Java emulator on our website.
Yes, we have an emulator for the 1620 on the website.
And it's slow and cheap.
Cheap. Yeah.
We want to thank our docents Stan Seeler and Robert Stetson for setting the whole thing up. We had a great time and encourage you to visit the Computer History Museum if you're in the Silicon Valley area. Look them up on the web at computerhistory.org. Thanks for listening to Technorama. If you have any comments or feedback about this or other episodes in the U.S., give us a call in the listener line at 206-222-2428. An easy way to remember that is 206-222-CHAT. If you're outside the U.S., we recommend using Skype for free computer-to-computer calls. Just download Skype from skype.com and add Chuck Chat to your buddy list. You could also send us an email at technorama@chuckchat.com. We'd love to hear from you. Technorama can be found at chuckchat.com, where you can find out more about our regular show and how to get it automatically delivered to you. This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech. You can find out more at friendsintech.com. We're also affiliated with Farpoint Media and all the great shows there. Visit them at farpointmedia.net for a great collection of audio content. Thanks for listening. Share Technorama with a friend. And until next time, a binary high five.
101.